Hello and welcome back to part two of episode 49 of Vegan Week. Part two, you say? Yes, we started the headlines, we got about 20 minutes in, and then realised the rest of the show was going to take nearly another hour, so we've split it in two to make it easier to digest. Think hummus rather than chickpeas. We have got all of the discussion in this episode. If you just wanted the headlines, you're listening to the wrong show, really. You need to listen to part one. Anyway, enough of the falafel, let's get on with the rest of the show.
So, Julie, what's your standout story for this week, would you say?
I'm taking us back to good old Devon and onto the filthy factory farm, I'm sorry to say.
Thank you so much.
Story. Yeah, I know. Yeah, I just wanted to talk about this farm specifically, but also because I think it's relevant for all factory farms everywhere. So the footage was filmed undercover in October last year over four non-consecutive nights by a company called Glasswall Films. They're a very new company. They say that they were interested to document how animal welfare has improved over time on British farms. I really don't know what gave them the idea that that had happened. And I think that might be a cover story. I don't know.
I was going to say that's surely like ironic or a cover story. Like no one thinks that, do they? Especially if you're called Glasswall.
Well, that's, you see, it's not Glasswalls, plural. I would have thought that that's referencing the quote about if slaughterhouses had glass walls.
Yes.
But Glasswall is more of a media term, isn't it, for something else. So yeah, I can't remember now. I did look this up because I thought, but I think it's more about being distanced from what you're looking at, or, you know, providing an objective view or something. It's not about the whole slaughterhouse thing, because they do other stuff. They're not,
yeah, I'm on their website now. It's not specifically animal rights at all.
Yeah. But good on them for going in there. The farm was investigated in 2017 by Animal Equality, who found similarly disgusting practices and conditions for the pigs. So it looks like, if anything, things are even worse, not better. A National Pig Association spokesperson has acknowledged, and I quote, that some elements are not best possible practice, but that the farm has been found to be compliant with all requirements, which is horrible to think about. But that's really my point. This is factory farming. It's animals, masses of them. I mean, thousands upon thousands of animals indoors in unnatural, cramped, necessarily filthy conditions, being treated en masse and like inanimate objects with absolutely no concern for their individual well-being. It would just be impossible with those kinds of numbers. They are just managed and no more, and kept alive and no more. And the whole point of the exercise is to raise them and get as much out of them as possible at the lowest possible cost. So that's just exploitation at its most extreme. The vast majority, I think I've seen different percentages all over the place, but it's some places say it's as high as 95%, you know. It can range from 70% up to 95%, depending on what you're looking at and where you're looking at it. Meat and dairy products in the UK come from factory farming. And I think maybe that vegetarians think that they're not supporting this hideous industry, but if they are buying or consuming dairy products or eggs, then they definitely are. And some people, and I was talking to one recently, say that they are only buying animal products from local farms so that they are not contributing to this. But when they go on holiday, go to cafes and restaurants, eat out anywhere, maybe when they're at work, going to a canteen, going to friends' houses, or feeding their pets, then they are fueling this industry, whether they like it or not.
And there's a brilliant point in the book that you've lent me, Julie, Regenesis by George Monbiot, in terms of that the fact that that's simply not a system that could be rolled out for everybody. Like, not everybody in the country could eat that way.
And so it becomes this.
Yeah. And so it becomes this kind of elitist hierarchical thing, whereas some people could afford to do it and everyone else either has to choose not to eat that way and ditch meat and dairy altogether, or just settles for the lower grade welfare stuff. It's just not an argument, is it?
But it also continues to so-called normalize that type of consumption, so that if you stay a meat eater, then the day that your farm shop is shut, you will just very easily go over to the other version of what you're used to having. Whereas if you were to stop eating meat and lose your taste for it and become sort of repelled by it, then that wouldn't happen. But it's still feeding that industry indirectly. It's still fueling the demand for meat and dairy products and making their consumption seem acceptable and accessible.
Yeah.
So what can we do about this? Because it can feel like you're powerless. You know, there's over 1,000 of these factory farms that are the size of mega farms in the UK. They're actually growing in number, which is shocking. You would think there would be. I think it's almost because the dairy industry and the meat industry are getting squeezed now. They're looking to this model to cut their costs, perhaps. So what can we do? You can campaign against individual factory farms getting built if that's your style. If one is proposed for your area, you can campaign against it. And there are some campaigns going on right now, as we know. It's a little bit NIMBY though, isn't it? Because, you know, you do not want to be the person who is simultaneously fueling demand for these by your own consumption, campaigning against one in your area and thinking it's fine for people in other areas and fine for animals. So I would try and kind of appeal to your better natures and say, please don't do that. You could do that as well as just campaign against the end of factory farming altogether. You can do that through the Compassion and World Farming website, probably on other places as well. But the main thing is, anything you can do to stop fueling demand for meat and dairy products helps to bring this industry down. Whether it's looking at your own consumption, what you're feeding your pets, what you're buying for other people, what you are talking to other people about, let's just get the demand gone, and then hopefully factory farms will be history.
Yeah, well said, well said. I am in looking at this story, I also saw this brilliant organization that the solicitors firm that's quoted in the story that you'll see in the show notes, called Advocates for Animals, and they dub themselves as the UK's first animal law firm. A quick look through their website is really inspiring, actually. Great to see organisations like doing their bit.
Absolutely. And talking of other things, I don't know if we've got the equivalent in the UK, but in America, we have got an organisation called Transfarmation, and they give advice and grants and things to factory farms and factory farmers, more importantly, who would like to change their way of making a living, so that these big sheds can be utilised for things like growing mushrooms, which they're far better suited for than putting sentient beings in. So they can grow mushrooms in there, they can grow vegetables and things. That's the other thing I would say, as well as, you know, get out of the habit of consuming the products of this hideous industry. Know that when you buy the peaceful plant-based alternative, that you are contributing in a very positive way to a much healthier, more ethically sound alternative. So enjoy filling up your basket with fruit and vegetables and mushrooms and whatever else you're buying. So, Ant, what is it that you would like to focus on?
Well, I think that the story that kind of gave me the biggest sort of emotional reaction was this last one that you commented on, Julie, in your section, the 13-year-old boy who was arrested along with his family members at this demo in Starbucks. And I have to say, I have really mixed feelings on it. I knew I was going to comment on it straight away. It was going to be my story. But the tack I was going to go down is kind of perhaps a little different to how I'm feeling now. Initially, I felt concerned for the young man himself in that my first response was, oh gosh, like how consensual has this been that he's part of that? And that's partly because my sort of professional work day to day is looking at children's consent and how self-directed they're able to be in their lives. And advocating for children in that way is a big part of my day to day job. And so my first thought was like, oh my goodness, has he been coerced to be here? Like, and now he's ended up arrested. Or is there, I think my next concern was, I don't know, sometimes when you're a teenager, let's say, I'm going to generalize here, but you can feel the need to, you know, be vitriolic, cathartic, and you know, the world's against you. You need to rage against the machine, and to do so in a way that ends up getting arrested is very different to doing so in a way that's just, I don't know, cathartic in a harmless way. So my first thought was about that, and thinking, oh gosh, like this feels like it might be a bit irresponsible to be encouraging somebody to be doing something like that. Obviously, I'm making assumptions, or I'm questioning, you know, were these things done? But then also, I kind of went on to think, well, if we had someone on the show here, or we were listening to a podcast and interviewing an avid animal rights protester, activist, who'd been doing this for 50 years, and we were saying, my God, haven't they made such a difference to the outcomes for animals? Like, what a fantastic job they've done. Let's hear about their story. And if their story began with, well, you know, the first demo I did was when I was 13 in Starbucks. I got arrested, you know, and blah, blah, blah. We'd probably look at that and go, oh, God, isn't that funny? You know, and like, oh, what a legend getting involved from such a young age. So I don't really know how I feel about this. And I guess, you know, I'll be honest, I've not done reams of research like Julie and Kate both do for their stories. I'm just going with my gut here, and I'd be interested in what the two of you think, and listeners too. But it's an interesting line to tread when we've got young people wanting to advocate for animals in a, this isn't necessarily direct action, although, well, it's pretty direct, and there's certainly some action going on, isn't there? But it's an interesting ethical quandary. And I mean, maybe I'll stop talking now and see Julie, Kate, what you think about this. Like, if you got concerns of like, oh gosh, should this minor, this legal minor, be doing this, or is it really inspiring, or where do you fall down?
I'm not worried for him. I saw the video of this. He seems genuinely invested. He looked genuine, I thought. Two things I would say about this story, though. It was an interesting kind of parallel, almost. I mean, the mum saw the irony of this, because she's shouting, what are you doing to my child? Don't take my child away. Just like what happens in the dairy industry.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, really. And she's pregnant and everything. You couldn't make it up. You know, it's perfect. Mm. What I would say, I don't know anything about Starbucks. Is it Starbucks?
Yeah.
I've never been in one of these places. I don't drink coffee, actually. But I don't know if they sell anything else. But they've got plant-based milk, which is at least something. They're charging a bit more for it. It's probably, I don't know, you'll know, Ant, in the catering world, I think we've had this conversation, it might be a bit more expensive, because look how abused cows are. Milk prices are very low. I would take them on about the fact there's cow's milk in there more than the fact that their plant milk's a bit more expensive.
Yeah, it seems like a really odd hill to die on for me, like picking up on that, oh, it's your surcharge.
I would take on the companies where there are no plant milks first, if there are none left in America, I don't know. But anyway, that's my take on it. But I thought the whole video was very moving, and... I thought it was interesting that the mum picked up on, you know, this is what happens to dairy cows. And I'm delighted that this is in the news. It is big news, and it should be. They were so rough with that wee boy. If I'd been there, I tell you, I wouldn't have been able to stop myself, I don't think. But yeah, that was horrible to watch. And if they get an absolute pasting for that, they deserve it.
No, I was just going to say, I had a hunt for the video and I don't know why, I couldn't find it. So I'll have another hunt after the show because it does sound horrendous. We've got so many activists that started at a very young age, and many of whom are still very young, like Genesis Butler and people like that. So I don't know. I hate the thought of him getting arrested and it obviously sounding quite violent, but I don't suppose it will stop him. It'll probably just fire him up. Good on him, really.
I think there's a response. We need to have an episode that is there such a thing as the vegan movement? Because like, if there is, and there's some sort of collective direction or some sort of collective responsibility there, I think we do need to look at the responsibility for, like, there's a 13-year-old boy with a criminal record now, potentially, who's doing so. Mm. Yes, he's advocating for animals, but really the hill he's dying on here is a 50p surcharge for plant milk. Like, is that really worth it? Now, I completely agree with what you're saying, Julie. Like, we do need to rally against the fact that, like, there's a business there exploiting animals. My guess is that Peter's gone for, because it was a Peter protest, they've targeted that because it's a well-known company and maybe that is perceived as a winnable battle. You're not going to persuade Starbucks to drop dairy milk at this stage in the game, but you might persuade them to drop the surcharge. So that's my guess. I don't know, but I guess that's a strategy. But like, I just feel like it's a real shame if that young man is disadvantaged through this in some way. Obviously, it will be upsetting and traumatic. And it's not necessarily his fault that he's been arrested. That could just be heavy-handed law enforcement or whatever. But like, I think we just need to question, is this a cost that we're willing to pay as a movement? I'm not suggesting it's been solicited. No animal rights organization is soliciting teenagers to go out and do its bidding, but it has happened. And I think once something happens once, you have to respond to it. That's part of, gosh, I'm sounding like a nerd, but that's part of risk assessment. Like, something happens and you say, right, okay, now we know this can happen. Maybe we need to look at things slightly differently. I've got no answers. I'm giving no solutions here. But I think for me, it's just a little wincy red flag. It's like, oh gosh, a teenage passionate animal advocate has got arrested here about a milk surcharge. Is that what we want to continue happening? Or do we want to tweak things slightly? Food for thought.
If he's going to be an animal activist, you'll need to get used to getting arrested.
Well, unfortunately.
And the police really have overreacted, basically, as well. Complete overreaction, you know, arresting a 13-year-old boy.
Seems to be, yes. Yeah. Seems to be. Anyway, send in your emails on that one. I'm sure there'll be a few people with some thoughts. Kate, what is your pick for the week's news? Which one are you going for?
Since I live in Norfolk and we have quite a lot of wildlife reserves and an awful lot of bird watchers come here on their holes, I thought I would pick the one about bird slaughter from animalreader.com on Cyprus. Yeah, horrendous numbers. 435,000 wild birds killed by hunters in Cyprus last autumn.
That's an absurd number, isn't it? Like, Cyprus is a small country.
Crazy.
And that's like 3 months.
I know, it's crazy, isn't it? Also, there are other places as well. Malta apparently is really bad, and that's a tiny little place. I guess a lot of these birds are migrating, I think. Mm. So they're caught mid-hop. They're having a little rest and then they get caught.
Jeez.
But that is like 90,000 more birds than the previous autumn, as we already said. The practice, how they're caught, is indiscriminate. 157 different bird species are caught and eaten, including tiny, tiny little birds. You would think it was hardly worth it, really, for the merest morsel. And 90 of these species are recognised as conservation priority species under the EU Birds Directive. So they're really becoming endangered. And the horrible methods that are used to catch them. They're luring them into nets, but they're also using glue traps, which is absolutely horrendous. Just like the two hideous characters from Roald Dahl's The Twits that, you know, like this is the worst sort of person you can be. You can glue birds to trees, you know. Yeah. And then they're sold on illegally to restaurants. So some UK bird watchers have been saying that they will never holiday there because of this practice. But others think that money from tourism will encourage the ending of this practice as people see the value of people coming to watch the birds rather than eat the birds. But I don't know. I've sort of met so many bird watchers. I'm sure you both have as well. But they just don't seem to be able to join the dots sometimes. I just wish they would actually see what's going on in the UK also and see that it's all connected. And it's no good us pointing our fingers at those people over there doing all that when there's stuff going on over here, which is no good for birds either. So, yeah, some people, they think nothing of going bird watching and then going and having a lovely fried breakfast or of meat, fried meaty breakfast or roast chicken or something when they get back. So not only are chickens and turkeys sentient beings forced to live a miserable life, unable to express any of their natural behaviours, but as we know, poultry units are the cause of massive outbreaks of bird flu. And last year in the UK, 50,000 wild birds died from bird flu, and that's likely to be a massive underestimate. This is bearing in mind that the amount of wild birds we have here in the UK is ludicrously small in the first place compared to the number of birds bred for human consumption, and that is largely due to their habitat destruction by animal agriculture in order to feed all the pigs, the chickens and cows, etc. And the number of poultry birds slaughtered per week in the UK is you two probably knew this, but I didn't realise, 23 million birds a week. Can you imagine? Jeez. That's appalling, isn't it?
Yeah.
I wish if only these conservationists would look beyond their stomachs to understand how they could make a real difference to wild birds here in the UK, and not just by stopping trapping in other countries, but you know, if we stopped eating them here, then we'd have so much more room for wild birds. We'd have get their habitats back and the insects back, and it, you know, we could make a massive difference.
I think it's heartening at least to hear that it does seem to be a demand driven thing. It's not just people are just having this wild urge to just shoot loads of birds or glue them to trees, like you say. It's incredible how something like the Twits Roald Dahl story is actually happening in real life.
But it
does suggest that actually if the demand to consume these animals as a foodstuff can come down, then actually it will affect the practice. Obviously that's a big if.
Well, how do they even have it on a menu? Oh, owl tart. Who would like owl tart? Or you know, it's just the most bizarre thing, really. Oh, anyway.
Yeah.
So now we're going to move on to our main story, which is all about the industrial scale of pheasant shooting. This comes from protectthewild.org. And Anthony, I believe you might have a few facts about this story.
Yeah. I mean, I was really grateful when Julie forwarded this to me earlier this week. It's actually part of a campaign that I was aware of before, and I'd really encourage listeners, I'm assuming a lot of our listenership are compassionate people who are driven by social injustice. Well, the Who Owns England campaign, there's a website, there's a book, which my partner very kindly got me for Christmas. Really interesting, all about, well, as the name suggests, land ownership and how it's being used in this country and things not being as they might initially seem, and the injustices around that. Well, the guy behind it, who is called Guy Shrubsole, he's submitted a series of freedom information requests on the poultry register made to the Animal and Plant Health Agency around rearing pheasants. And there's some really interesting findings that the kind of that the numbers really do a lot of the talking here. So there's 131 shoots in game farms in England. 131 shoots and game farms. They are responsible for rearing and releasing 6.2 million pheasants in England. So if you do the maths there, that is a staggering number of pheasants per shoot and game farm, if you like. And this whole Freedom of Information campaign has revealed just quite how horrific this is. So at most, Guy is saying 43 premises rear 4.7 million pheasants. Remarkable numbers. A big finding as you look through this article is the fact that, yes, a staggering number are being reared in this country in quite a small space. So I think in Shropshire, near me, over a million pheasants are being raised just in that one county. So there's just no way of doing this in a, quote, humane way or in a way that's anything other than barbaric. It's often being done, or if not always being done, on land that is generally seen as, oh, it's, you know, it's the rolling countryside, it's the rolling hills, how wonderful. No, these are private estates where systematically these birds are being reared in high densities just to then be shot at by people with nothing better to do. But as well as all that going on, a huge number of these birds, who aren't necessarily native to this country in the first place, a huge number of them are being bred in France and then brought over here just to be shot. So it's not even this idyll of, oh, we're going hunting for a few local birds. They're being shipped over just to be shot at. It really, that the mind boggles. But obviously, we've got a link in the show notes about it. It's a quick read, really, the article. It's not very long if you're pressed for time. Obviously, animal rights is a very important issue, so it'd be good to make the time for these things. But if you've only got a few minutes spare, it's a really good one to look at. And just the final thing was that the impact, not just on these poor birds that are being killed, not just the local land that could be used for something else, could be rewilded, could be commons, people could, you know, wander this land at their whim if it wasn't being used for this, but actually to protect these birds. A lot of the people who are rearing them are then also hunting and illegally killing, persecuting other birds like buzzards, goshawks, I don't know if I've said that right, hen harriers, and basically other birds of prey that will be trying to eat these pheasants and red-legged partridges themselves. They're sort of natural predators, or certainly predators that do want to eat them because they're seen as a threat. Those animals, those predators are being killed too. So it's an all-round shit show, and it's fantastic that it's been exposed by Guy Shrubsole and the Who Owns England campaign. Julie, Kate, what were your takes on this?
Isn't it altogether about 50 million birds, I think? I think it's 40 million pheasants and 10 million red-legged partridges.
Beg your pardon, yeah, I've misread
that. Which is a ridiculous number. And apparently it's the same weight as all wild birds put together. I rest my case on the former thing. The same weight as all wild birds put together in the UK. That's terrible, isn't it?
Well, that's almost the same as the human population. In fact, in England, that is probably the same human population, isn't it? About 50 million people. Mm. Not far off, just being shot for fun.
Yeah.
It's absurd.
Yeah.
Absurd.
It's crazy.
I think the numbers might even be an underestimate because I don't know what authority could ever find out how many pheasant farms there are, because I know where I live in East Lothian, there are numerous pheasant farms, but they are hidden in woods, and near the place where you would go into the woods to get near them, it says, oh, you know, keep dogs on a lead, keep out of here, danger, you know, whatever, barbed wire over the gate, whatever. You're not allowed anywhere near seeing them. You have to know they're there, if you see what I mean. So they'll be hidden from sight. If they're just doing something that's totally above board, I don't know why they feel the need to hide them the way that they do, but they do hide them away in woods and places like that. And definitely the numbers of animals that are killed in the name of increasing the numbers artificially of, well, not increasing the numbers, but preventing them being preyed upon is huge. All the trapping that goes on, as you know, that's my specialist subject, is the animal trapping, you know, the snares and the glue traps and the spring traps and things. And that is because, yes, these little birds have been brought over from other countries. They've been factory farmed over in other countries and they're brought over here and then grown on here and then released for people shooting them. And in the meantime, they try and annihilate all of the animals in that area that might eat them. So everything is up for grabs just about for getting caught in these hideous traps. So they're killing tons of animals before they've even fired a single shot at these little birds. And they're just messing up the ecosystem as well.
Yeah, apparently a lot of wild animals eat the food that they leave for the pheasants. And that apparently is laced with antibiotics. So there's also a worry that, you know, we're going to, that's breeding antimicrobial resistance within the wild population as well of creatures.
Yeah, medicated grit is definitely an issue. And there's people putting out concentrations of it that are higher than they're allowed to be putting out. And there are also people putting out poison for rodents because they, and just quite close to where I live, there's poison out. I know exactly where it is. I've sent photographs of it away. But if a rodent then eats that poison and then a bird eats that rodent, then that bird's going to die as well. It's just horrible, horrible stuff.
So can we suggest some ways to improve this then? It's obviously the first step is having this exposed and learning about this, because without the information we can't act on it. So that's partly why we've reported on it and made it our main story. But like what other suggestions would we have between us? I mean, possibly because I was listening to an interview with one of the directors of Christspiracy yesterday, when I was thinking, oh, what should we do? I was thinking, well, let's go pheasantspiracy, because actually shining a light on these things, like getting that so it's widely spread. I mean, goodness me, like the number of threats that these filmmakers have had when making Cowspiracy and Seaspiracy, like goodness knows what the local gentry and landowners would do if they were having that investigated and documented on. There'd be a lot of threats made. But if you could wave a magic wand, that would go a long way, wouldn't it, I think?
I've been inspired by the fact that in the last week, two hunts have closed down because of sabbing activity. So I'm thinking there are already people who sab shoots. I don't know the tactics that are needed. They'll be very different from sab and fox hunting, because what you don't want to do is disrupt the activity and in the same time put the birds more at risk, you know, because it's a bit harder to predict what a bird is going to do, or a load of birds as opposed to one fox. It's a bit trickier, I think. But I think we need to start disrupting. So direct action, disrupting pheasant shoots for sure. There's legislation, certainly in Scotland, and I'll keep going on about Scotland, but we've got two things going on. We've got this new bit of legislation, the Wildlife Management and Muirburn Scotland Bill, going through our parliament at the moment, which is going to make licensing your land for shooting expensive and difficult. And that might serve to be a deterrent for people. And it's also going to do something to address the wild animals that are killed deliberately and inadvertently in the process. We've got this thing called Revive, the Coalition for Grouse Moor Reform. And it just shows you how, because I know we're talking about grouse here, but they're, you know, shot in the same way that pheasants are. It just shows you how far ingrained this issue is, that these beautiful expansive hills that I have close to me in East Lothian, the Lammermuir Hills, is called a grouse moor. As if nothing else lives there and nothing else happens apart from grouse live. It's not a grouse farm, it's not a grouse moor. It shouldn't be. It's some hills, for heaven's sake.
Yeah.
Anyway, This organisation has been set up. It's a group of how many? One, two, three, four different organisations to try to persuade the government to repurpose this land, rewild it, stop the shooting, return it back to a natural state. So yeah, something's happening, not fast enough and not enough, of course, but something. So yeah, getting it on all levels is what's needed.
Did anyone check out the British Association for Shooting and Conservation, by the way? An oxymoron if ever I'd heard one.
Go on, say a bit more about that.
Oh, did you not look them up? I had to. So they're claiming that shooting is worth £2 billion to the UK economy and provides 74,000 full-time jobs. I can't believe that, can you? Can you believe that?
Oh, great. Well, I tell you what, let's start up human slavery again, because that would probably generate a bit of income, create some jobs. Like, that's not
you're not
a defense.
Wrong. No,
is it? Like, it's not a defence. Let's start human trafficking.
But that's
come on.
That is the size of a small town, though, isn't it? Like 74,000 people. Yeah. Quite a large town, actually. You know,
it's about a grand to go shooting. Just to,
is it?
Yeah, just for a not even a whole day. Just to go shooting is about a grand. Yeah. You get your lunch for that, mind.
They don't even eat them, though, do they, half the time?
Not even meal included. But yeah, you get your lunch and you get to go about your gun and stuff like that.
Do you think they do vegan options? Because I'm vegan, so.
Yeah, I'm going to try booking on. The video that I saw, there's a website where you can just go to one handy place to book your shooting, and the video is so smarmy, it's worth watching, it's nauseating. But I like to find out where there are shoots going on, because I am starting to do a bit of research into how to sap these things. So I'm just starting off with, you know, how do you find them? So, yeah.
I don't know how would you do it? How would you do it without getting shot yourself, that is, accidentally, you know?
Yeah.
You see, the only thing I've ever done, and I don't know if this was helpful for the birds or not, which is why I need to do my research. I really need to learn how to do this, because the only thing I've ever done in the past, I've done it a few times, but when I found these pheasant farms, I've just disconnected their electric fence and opened their gate and let them out. But I might be putting them in more danger doing that. I don't know.
I don't see how you could be putting birds that are clearly going to be shot and killed.
They might be safer in there from yeah, I don't know. But I sort of gave them the choice. Yeah. I've switched the fence and opened the gate and was like, well,
Yeah.
You've got wee houses to hide in if a fox comes.
Yeah. They're gonna get shot anyway, aren't they? So you're at least giving them a chance rather than no chance.
That's all I've managed so far.
I'm gonna put out my call to action, as there's a couple of campaigns that I learned about over the summer, one of which I've already mentioned, that the Who Owns England campaign, and then the Right to Roam campaign. And what I found refreshing about both of these is that they are not vegan specific things. Of course, there's nothing wrong with being vegan, but I think sometimes it can feel like we're a minority, and oh gosh, it's an uphill struggle, you know, swimming against the current here. However, what I've really liked about that is just dipping my toe in and speaking with a few people, going on a couple of walks with people who are really excited, and they really want to take action on a social injustice that it's like intersectionality. All of these injustices in the end lead back to one another, which is why it's really important to lend our support to different social injustice issues. And sometimes it's just nice to read about something that's not directly to do with animals, but clearly affects them still. So kind of like land ownership, the fact that these things are shut off. And, you know, great that there are lots of local Right to Roam groups that you can go along to. You can take part in a bit of civil disobedience if you want to. Also, a great group of people to, you know, learn about veganism while you're there. Take along a vegan picnic. There's going to be people there who are interested in social injustice. Sorry, I keep saying social injustice. You know what I mean? They want there to be social justice. So a great group of people to spend time with, I think, too. So That's and a couple of books, like I say, I got for Christmas that are on that subject that all links back to animal abuse in the wild.
That's great. And I think a lot of human ills are partly because we have lost contact with the land. You know, we've been chucked off it actually as well. But yeah, we'd all be so much better if we just rolled around in the mud a bit more, I think.
That's what I get paid to do every week.
Lucky you. So there's also the organisation Wild Justice, who are campaigning to end pheasant shooting and a whole load of other really important things too. There's the League Against Cruel Sports as well that people can look up. They're a great organisation. And there's also Animal Aid, and they're encouraging people to get hold of their postcards and send them to MPs, etc., and to have street stalls. So there's other ways to actually physically get involved as well to try and end this atrocity. Talking of bringing atrocities to an end, that's the end of our conversation.
So, listeners, what did you think about the main story? What are your views on the shooting industry and what we can do about it? Or what are your views on anything that we've covered in the show? Any thoughts that you have, we'd love to hear them. Please send them in to enoughofthefalafel@gmail.com.
Indeed. Well, thank you everyone for listening as well. We're always really grateful for everyone that's put the time in and that deems our little podcast worthy of listening to. If you're new to the show, you weren't aware, there are lots of other episodes of Enough of the Falafel Productions. Just scroll back. They're not all new shows as well. So this is our Vegan Week show, but we also have Vegan Talk, where we get chewy in chewy discussions, interesting philosophical debates and the like. And if you go back to January's episodes, there's about 10. They've got a little green banner on your podcast player, and they're called the Going Vegan series. And each of those just interviews one person. Kate's been on it, Julie has been on it, as well as 8 others, just listening to people's individual vegan journeys. Really interesting, those. I'd suggest giving those a listen if you haven't already.
So coming out on Thursday is our next episode of Vegan Talk, and this week it's going to be Ant and myself talking to Julie about her wonderful sheep and learning all about them.
Yes,
so one not to be missed. Yeah.
Whoop. Anyway, that's enough of the falafel for this episode. I've been Julie.
I've been Anthony.
And I've been Kate. And you've been listening to episode 49 of Vegan Week.